This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Well, the days of getting our facts from the evening news and our entertainment from an episode of Friends are over. The lines between news, gossip, and entertainment have increasingly blurred. And we've gotten now, we live in a culture, really, which is so cynical that even presenting a birth certificate doesn't qualify as proof that, for instance, Barack Obama was born in the U.S. Constantly bombarded with information, photos, tweets, memes, all of that has to be quickly interpreted as fact or fake. How do we navigate this barrage of information? Returning to the State of Things is Brian Southwell. He's Program Director of Science in the Public Sphere at RTI International and a professor at both UNC Chapel Hill and Duke, and the author of the new book, Misinformation and Mass Audiences. Brian Southwell, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much, Frank. I really appreciate being here, and I appreciate your attention to this topic.
Well, it's one that's almost hard not to pay attention to, right? We hear about fake news all the time, and we get it. There are deliberate lies planted in the news that then gets, you know, distributed by people who may or may not know how accurate it is. Let's talk about the process, the mind process, the human process of discerning whether something is a fact or not. You talk about that in your book.
Yeah. You know, actually, that's one of the reasons why we put the book together, along with my co-editors, Emily Thorson and Laura Chablais. We were interested in this phenomenon and trying to figure out why it seems to be a persistent problem. And there are a number of really good reasons for that. Part of it has to do with that basic human psychology that you talked about. We actually are biased towards acceptance of information at face value. And there's a longstanding philosophical debate that goes back all the way back to Descartes and Spinoza, in which we were trying to figure out what we do when we discern and detect false information. And Descartes, in the olden days, was sort of talking about our ability to filter that out or screen it out. And Spinoza had a slightly different account. He suggested that we actually take in information, accept it, and then later tag it as being true or false. And that slight step, that subtlety, actually makes all the difference because, empirical evidence seems to bear him out to support that. And it suggests that there's this complication because we actually accept information. And then if we have the energy or the time or the effort, we can label that as being true or false. But it leaves the door open for the spread of misinformation.
Now, that the scenario that you just painted, in other words, okay, I'm going to take you in provisionally, then we're going to check you out, fact.
Yeah.
Makes a lot of sense, particularly for something that's brand new. But then the filter that Descartes talked about strikes me as another way of talking about prejudice or pre-existing ideas. And therefore, if it made sense to me, if I don't like Barack Obama, I love hearing that he might not be a citizen. So I'm more inclined to accept that, right? And it's passed through a filter.
Well, right. So there's an interesting aspect of what you just pointed out, Frank, which is another complication for us and something we have to pay attention to, which is we like to talk to one another. We have reasons for connecting with one another. And some of that has to do with our shared sense of identity or bonding, maybe even more than caring about the exact accuracy of a fact. And that's something that is core to our humanity, but at the same time, it also complicates this because maybe I don't really believe this, but there's some value in sharing that with you because of what that says about what I think about this group that we're in.
So my membership in the group is contingent on whether or not I accept the fact that the group accepts.
Yeah. And also think about even instances when you pass something along somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but or you're laughing at it, or you're even saying something critical of it, you're still passing it along. And so it's easier than ever before to share information with one another, with the technology makes that possible. That's another reason why we might worry about that. But at the same time, misinformation is not a new problem. We've had this. We've lied to each other for a long time, right?
Yeah, but the velocity and the scale, is it. I'm going to play a clip now about, the consequences, Google or Facebook. This is one of the news pieces after the mass shooting in Las Vegas in October. And it just talks about, number one, the velocity and, two, the scale at which information can be passed along.
Well, Google and Facebook are apologizing for amplifying false news stories that surfaced in the hours after the shooting. According to the Chronicle, Google blamed an algorithm for highlighting stories that falsely identified an innocent man as the shooter.
Within hours of the attack, Gary Danley's name and his photo were spread across the internet.
Our family and all of our extended family, the Danleys, have been getting death threats.
Right, so there we are. This is just one example of how far and wide the lie can spread, right?
Yeah. You know, we might think about the Googles of the world and the social media platforms, and there are really important discussions to have about the ethical responsibility that they might have. They are distributors of information, and they're not in that way, that different than other media outlets. At the same time, we might also worry about, the absolute remedy that might be in some people's mind, which would be a lot closer to censorship than I'd be careful. Or that I'd be comfortable with. And so there's this trade-off. I think there absolutely is a responsibility for the information that gets distributed. At the same time, we want to make sure we don't have a system that's so sanitized and so airtight that we can't – the truth can't find its way in there.
Well, here's Dianne Feinstein talking at a hearing in the U.S. Senate. Of course, California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein, who's in a Senate hearing, putting her finger on just that possibility. Let's listen.
You've created these platforms, and now they are being misused. And you have to be the ones to do something about it, or we will.
Right, there you go. Senator Dianne Feinstein, that's a congressional hearing. She's threatening lawyers representing Google, Facebook, and Twitter. It's interesting that she says that because there was a time when mass media, when it was, conventional media like newspapers, radio, and television, did just that. They began regulating themselves rather than wait for the government, right?
Yes. No. And that's what's partly fascinating about this story is that we're seeing a cyclical a swing of the pendulum, if you will, and sort of this rediscovery periodically that as a society, we have these different media outlets and entities and communication outlets to serve this larger goal of trying to organize ourselves. And periodically, we realize that it might be useful for them to be self-policing to some extent or to monitor. But that obligation, that responsibility is one that we continue to sort of discover, again, over the past decade.
Yeah, but I wonder if there's a break in the cycle here, because when newspapers began to regulate themselves and come up with their own standard and protocols and standards of ethics that were better than what was at the turn of the century when
yellow journalism
was rampant. Yeah. Well, one of the things it did was it hurt the reputation of the press. And so one of the ways they tried to get that back was to say, no, we've got this promise. Here's our pledge. We do things by these rules. It was a business decision. If you're these platforms, the business depends on the transmission of this stuff. So the more people do it, whether it's true or not, the better it is for you, right?
Well, is that entirely – I mean, I think that they're under the current model. That seems to be – there's a lot of value on attention and on exactly that. It may be the case that people are able to carve out a subscription-based model where people value the experience and they're willing to pay for that. Maybe that's a possibility. And I guess also collectively, on some level, it's an interesting question how far you can go to push in terms of credibility. Eventually, information turns out to be true or factual or useful in predicting the future or not. And you sort of wonder whether some of these social media platforms, if they were so riddled with falsehoods, if they really could sustain sort of all of the impact of that in terms of reputation. It's an open question.
Well, how much of it do you think is their response? I mean, obviously, we have, the Russians made a deliberate effort to affect the United States elections, and it worked. So part of that is, all right, well, we got to examine these platforms, right? But the other part of that is, what do we say about the platform itself? Does it have a responsibility to edit, to vet this information? And then again, how close do we come to censorship if you say yes?
Right. No, it's an interesting question. And I want to be careful not to sort of formally pass judgment in terms of policy, but in terms of thinking about the alternatives and the range that's there. We can view these organizations as being in the business of gathering up and distributing information, regardless of whether it's happening from peer to peer or it's happening on a broader scale in the case of broadcast TV. And so I think it's reasonable for us to think about them in that same framework and for us to make decisions as a society as to what we want to do about that. And so I think it's okay and reasonable to have the question anyway as to whether
what would it look like? Is it because to some extent, and you talk about this in the book too, let's talk about this for a moment and then talk about a possible remedy.
Yeah.
Part of the problem is that the disinformation, right, the fake news gets out there. So I write a fake article and I plant it on one of these platforms. And of course, the beauty of it is it'll be distributed by people who didn't particularly know. They weren't in on this conspiracy, right. But they do it. Once that happens, their friends, because of the algorithm that Facebook or Twitter has created, are going to keep getting news like that. And it's the silo effect, this secondary effect that you also write about.
Right. No, this is a really fascinating arena now to kind of figure out what the right remedies could be, both in terms of technological possibility and in terms of, you know, ethics. And that's something that actually we're part of an effort right now with the Rita Allen Foundation to be issuing a call for technological innovation and educational innovation in the remedy of against the spread of misinformation. So we're going to be actually working on that later this year with a big forum in Washington, D.C. But I think that there are possibilities that have to do with the mechanics of how these platforms operate. And they're thinking about this all the time, too. Trust me.
But can they? So would it be an algorithm that says, okay, from now on, if you get a story that leans this way, and we know how to judge that, we know how to read this article and tell who likes it, we're going to feed you articles, you know, who other Facebook users are sending to themselves. You're not likely to see this given our current algorithm. We're going to make it a policy decision to send you essentially both sides of the story.
Well, it's an interesting and useful option to consider. And in fact, there's some new empirical evidence to suggest that there'd be some value in that. So Emily Vraga and Letitia Bode actually have a paper out a few years ago in which they looked at exactly that. If you present essentially counter information or corrective information alongside what people are seeing in the feed, there is some utility in that. They are able to correct and people appreciate, you know, seeing the range of options. So it's possible now that the choice is going to be theirs, you know, both for the organizations and for what we demand, both as consumers and citizens of these entities that are serving us ultimately, right?
I mean, the trick there is, and I want to get to the brain process that you just touched on in a second, but before that, just writing this other algorithm and sort of now I'm becoming a real gatekeeper, so I'm acting a little bit more like a conventional journalism outfit, right? I'm saying, get the other side. You know, you can't present this side without the other side. We wouldn't do it. Facebook does, because that's, in fact, I only want that side because that's what their friends are looking at. Right?
Yeah. But, you know, the nature of algorithms are such that there are patterns and processes regardless. I think the sort of notion of everything being purely neutral is probably an illusion. We've always had a situation where people are paying attention to what was most liked or, even just timing. There are these different dimensions that filter into what you see. So it's not, you can't possibly see everything that all of your friends are posting anyway. And so in the moment that you step into a filtered or curated feed of any sort, decisions get made.
Yeah, and there's a gatekeeper. So, all right, so now let's talk about, again, this process of weighing and evaluating. You talked about some utility. When people see both sides, it does have some effect. I mean, I wonder if that works in this universe where people have really chosen to be in this silo. These are my friends. They're all talking about Barack Obama not being a citizen. Am I really going to read the article that says, wait, here's his birth certificate? I mean, how does that work in terms of this evaluation, going back to Descartes or Spinoza? Once it's in that sequestered room, what do we do then to do the check?
Right. Well, so there's a couple things to consider. One, we know that correction can happen, but it's hard work, and that you have to be very explicit about saying that something that you just heard was false, and here's why. And so, but that can move the needle, but are people going to willingly sort of engage in that? Part of the question is what experience do we want to have possible for people? And part of our decision criterion has to be, I think, ultimately, from an ethical standpoint, what decisions people would make if given full information. We can't dictate for them what they do with information or what they see necessarily, but giving them the option or the range, part of what we might worry about is the isolation of people in a situation where they don't realize that they don't have access to the truth or to facts or to, and maybe that's what's happening in terms of some of the siloing effect, where people don't necessarily realize. I'm interested by the possibility that many people, given a wider range of information, would make different decisions or would feel differently about the misinformation they saw. If those people might change their mind, that's something we ought to worry and think about. Feeding all of the information we can to those folks. In instances in which people have an array and of information they're going to choose and select out, there's only so much that can be done about that. And that's one of the reasons why we have to be careful this doesn't devolve into just what your opinion is or my opinion is. And some of this debate, and you know, there are folks that would even criticize the use of the word fake news as kind of pulling this in as a lazy move by some pundits, because it actually – there are facts. There are a range of information we can expose people to. And this can't just be a matter of, well, I don't like what you say, so I'm going to filter that out or label it. That's a different conversation, though.
Sure, but I mean, there's an obvious and factual difference between that story, which was constructed out of pure lies in order to generate a particular kind of emotional response, and an analysis of a public policy decision that is wildly different, but sees the facts in a different way and comes down on it differently. That's a whole different arena, right?
Right. And I think it's healthy and okay for us to acknowledge both of those possibilities being content that people engage with, and to be careful to not think in a black or white way about if you think about it, even the iteration and evolution of scientific information means that at some point, things that we used to think, 100 years later, we think differently about because of new evidence. Well, does that mean – what is that? It doesn't mean that people – you might worry about willful intent and the best knowledge we have based on facts currently.
All right. Now, let's talk about the users again and come back to us and our responsibility in all this. I mean, the fact is we are all using – many people are using these platforms – and they know this is what's going on, right? I mean, it's pretty well documented at this point. Are we somehow delusional about the fact that that kind of trick only works on other people? They'd never fool me, because otherwise I think I'd be off that platform. If I were on it, I would be off it in a heartbeat, given what I know.
Yeah. No, I think what's great about what you just pointed out is the role that we do all play in this. And I don't know. I think it's still possible, even in 2018, for us to overstate the extent to which 100% of our fellow citizens are fully aware of the depths of some of this. And that's part of the reason for the book, and part of the reason for this discussions like this, is that in certain circles, there's a lot of hue and cry about this. But I think in other situations, I don't know that there's necessarily been as much of a spotlight per se, or it's been more cynically cast. And so I think there is room for us to have a larger discussion about this. But I also think there's another aspect of what you just said, which is that given more exposure, people might make different decisions about the value and their consumption of these different outlets. And I think that's okay too. It's all right for some folks to sort of fall away in terms of audience if they've been serving misinformation.
Or become more critical in the way they evaluate it. So that could be the good side of all the publicity. The downside is that you become so cynical that it's a pox on all of your houses and you don't believe anybody.
Right. And that's something when I talk about this with students, when I talk about that, I would hate to see us get in that situation, because it's a hopeless one, and I don't think we have to be there. I think that we've found ways over time to surveil our world and to come up with facts that we agree are useful, that are predictive, that tell us that this is happening, and in 50 years this is what the state of our coast or whatever is going to look like, and it happens, and then we see and we're grateful for having gathered up that information. We just need to reevaluate why we have news outlets, why we have information outlets, and try to make sure that we do what we can to protect against some of these very understandable patterns and tendencies, which have to do with our humanity. They have to do with the nature of our regulatory systems. We live in the U.S. in a system that doesn't censor, but that instead does post-hoc detection of misinformation. That's true in all kinds of ways if you stop and think about it. And we have to think about why we get together and talk with one another, and maybe if there are better ways to bond with people over useful information rather than the memes that are making fun of X or Y group.
Sounds great. Wonderful book and a great conversation. Brian Southwell, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Frank. I appreciate it.
Brian is director of research at RTI International, a professor at both Duke and UNC Chapel Hill, and the co-author of the new book, Misinformation and Mass Audiences. And you can find more at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, a double bassist who brings Bach to troubled populations all around the world. Stay with us.